This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Our first stories for this week are going to come to us from GQ Magazine from September of 2025. And the first story, the cover story for this month's edition, is called How Travis Kelce Spent His Summer. Nobody has done more to spread the gospel of the NFL globally than three-time Super Bowl winner and Eras Tour super fan-in-chief Travis Kelce. Ahead of the new season, Kelce welcomed us to his under-the-radar training base in Florida to answer questions about life after the NFL, and it's what it's like to be Mr. Americana. Now, I know some people are tired of Travis Kelce and certainly tired of the Kansas City Chiefs, but you can't know. There's no questioning that he's big man on campus and he's a big personality, and it doesn't hurt to be, you know, the boyfriend of the biggest superstar on the planet. So here we go. In a dimly lit dining room in Miami, a waiter places a course of hamachi crudo in front of Travis Kelce. "We don't get freshness like this in Kansas City," Kelce says. "We're sitting in a horseshoe-shaped booth, and Kelce's voice can just be heard over that of the young woman on the restaurant stage covering Sade's The Sweetest Taboo and other Quiet Storm standards." Kelce did not encounter fish like this, raw, finely sliced, opalescent, growing up in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, either. "Red Lobster was a nice spot for us to go as a kid. We used to go there, see the lobsters in the tank like they were in an aquarium. We put on pants for that shit." Kelce is here in the swank, lean protein and rich people capital of the year, of the world, not just because it's a comfortable off-season home for a 35-year-old multimillionaire. Kelce is here in South Florida to get back to his roots, to reunite with Florida Fort Lauderdale-based speed and agility coach Tony Villani. Villani trained Kelce for his NFL combine more than a decade ago and has worked with Kelce during the summers for most of his professional career. Kelce took a hiatus from Villani a few years ago when the Kansas City Chiefs tight end moved his off-season training operations to Los Angeles, near his burgeoning second career in film and television. Now, though, Kelce has come back east to regroup from last season's lopsided defeat in the Super Bowl. "Win a Super Bowl is the only goal," Kelce says. "It's the only goal. It's every goal. It's been nearly 4 months since that defeat, and Kelce is still hard on himself about it. I think it might have slipped a little bit because I did have a little bit more focus in trying to set myself up. And opportunities came up where I was excited to venture into the new world of acting and being an entertainer," he says. "I don't say this as I shouldn't have done it. I'm just saying my work ethic is such that I have so much pride in how I do things that I never want the product to tail off, and I feel like these past 2 years haven't been to my standard." He adds, "I just have such a motivation to show up this year for my guys." His past 24 hours have been ridiculous. Yesterday, he woke up at 5 to drive to the Everglades for this story's photo shoot. He spent 12 hours trudging through swamps and cradling alligators and riding airboats. From there, he drove to the airport to catch an evening flight to Kansas City for a children's hospital charity event that night. The next day, he drove to the airport, caught a flight back to Miami, and came straight to dinner. At some point in this itinerary, Kelce also got a workout. "And after he's done with me, he's due to interview Shaquille O'Neal for an episode of New Heights, the podcast he co-hosts with his brother, former Philadelphia Eagles center Jason Kelce, which was licensed by Wondery last year in a deal reportedly worth $100 million. Beside the plate of hamachi is a cup of coffee, the only hint that he might be experiencing some fatigue. Kelce is not, to be clear, letting his squandered shot at a historic Super Bowl three-peat or his punishing off-season training stop him from having fun. His unapologetic zest for life is one of his superpowers, and it's key to his popularity. The sense that he knows what a lucky schmuck he is, can't believe it any more than you can, and damn it, he isn't going to endure every second while it lasts. The impression he gives off lately is of unrepressed joy, squint smiling through his newly long hair and the glare of paparazzi flashes as he goes to dinner or a Stanley Cup game with his partner, Taylor Swift. And besides, brooding self-pity is simply not in his nature. I love being the happiest guy in the world all the fucking time, he says. Kelsey is famously bad at hiding his emotions. One story he tells me is of when he was 23, preparing for his NFL draft and had the opportunity to meet Rob Chudzinski, then head coach of the Cleveland Browns, the team the Kelsey brothers zealously rooted for growing up. I cried in Chud's office and I said, I will fucking die for this city, Kelsey tells me. I literally was in tears. I said, I'm sorry I'm getting emotional. I grew up down the street. I would fucking do anything to play for the Cleveland Browns. He looked at me like I was insane. I don't think he'd ever had somebody just pour out their emotions. The Browns passed on Kelsey. So did every other team until the third round of the 2013 draft, when he was selected by the Chiefs, where ultimately, Kelsey turned out to be a perfect complement to the incoming future MVP quarterback, Patrick Mahomes. On the other end of so many of Mahomes' scrappy schoolyard plays, there was Kelsey, it probably open, commemorating a completion with a wider variety of dance moves than a junior high mixer. When I was younger in the league, he says, I used to have some of the older players come up to me and be like, man, you celebrate after every fucking catch. I'm like, I'm in the NFL, dude. I love this shit. I finally get the ball in my hands and I have millions of people watching me. This shit is exciting. 5 Super Bowl appearances and 3 rings later, and having surpassed Jerry Rice for the all-time lead in postseason and Super Bowl receptions, Kelsey has a strong case to be considered the greatest tight end ever. There will be arguments about him versus Gronk versus Tony Gonzalez, says Jason Kelsey, who, as New Heights listeners know, is more prone to giving his brother shit than praise. But I don't think anybody has ever been as unique of a player in that spot. Yet age and success have not tempered Travis's intensity. Not towards opposing players, not towards referees, not even towards his head coach, Andy Reid, whom Kelsey infamously and heatedly confronted on the sideline at the 2024 Super Bowl. He later apologized and said the two men had laughed about it. I get all my negative energy out when I play football, he says. When I'm out there on the field, I can hit somebody. I can talk shit. That's where the meaner side of me is, or the asshole side of me. Still, the Travis Kelsey I spent time with is different from the Travis Kelsey I expected. Though no less ebullient, he is more introspective. That football is shit money, Kelsey says. That thing can bounce your way, and it cannot bounce your way. There's a lot of fortune that goes into playing this game. It's this slightly philosophical bent that complicates the carefree, club-hopping, Midwestern bro persona that has made him so relatable and beloved. I'm starting to phase out of wanting to be known as the party guy, says the guy who MCs a namesake music festival in Kansas City that draws 27,000 spectators to see the likes of Diplo and Lil Wayne. The guy whose post-playoff victory routine is a guttural rendition of You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party, the Beast Boys. When you see me hanging out at the U.S. Open with Taylor, it may look like the two of us are partying, Kelsey says. But I'm just enjoying the fun of being at this really cool event that I always wanted to go to with the person that I love. Put another way, he says, I've become way more strategic in understanding what I am portraying to people. Later, during our time together, he tells me, I have a good understanding of how I want to be portrayed. It's not a new interest, exactly. At college, when Kelsey was suspended from the University of Cincinnati team for failing a drug test, marijuana, his brother Jason, who also played for UC, advocated for his reinstatement, and Travis was given another chance, but only if a number of conditions were met. Some of these have been well documented in the brothers' Amazon Prime and ESPN documentaries. No missed classes, a grade point average of 3.0. A lesser-known condition was, as Kelsey tells me, I had to sit down with a shrink for an hour a week. He got me to look at my life way more strategically. He got me to understand that you go through these emotions and your reaction can either help you or hurt you or be indifferent. He walked me through all these different phases of my life. How did this make you feel? How did you react? I started to understand and process these emotions completely differently. You start to control it and not let it get you too crazy. I'm curious how the media scrutiny, increased exponentially since he started dating Swift, affects him. Does he pay any attention to it? You can't block that out, he says. If someone says something that you don't like about you, you have to be able to understand how you're portraying yourself for them to say that. I don't want anyone to say anything negative about me. Some people don't give a fuck. I'm someone who does care. it requires a certain amount of vulnerability and bravery for someone of Kelsey's renown to admit what Kelsey is admitting here. Even with all his professional accomplishments, all his money and the luxury it buys, all his romantic prosperity, he still cops to the desire to be liked by strangers. He's willing to keep working to make you like him. Kelsey continues, I do want people to look at me like I'm doing good in the world. I'm influencing and using my platform for the better, being a role model, being somebody that has done it the right way. We're wrapping up dinner so Kelsey can get some much-deserved sleep before his morning speed workout when the restaurant singer approaches our table holding a wireless microphone. She starts to sing again, serenading us and only us with Lauryn Hill's X Factor. I feel my face go red and try to suppress an uncomfortable chuckle. This is way too intimate. I glance over at Kelsey, expecting to catch his eye and exchange some recognition of the awkwardness. But Kelsey has been quick to understand what I have not. The singer is simply doing her job. Our table, one mandatory stop in her nightly loop around the room. So he treats her with the same respect he's shown every other employee in the restaurant thus far, making eye contact with and thanking the staff to bring our food and fill our water glasses and clear our plates. He watches her attentively for the full minute she croons away at us until she slinks off to the next table. When you're trying to win your fourth Super Bowl, you don't go to a studio with eucalyptus-scented towels, an apparel shop, and a co-working space. You go to a gym. XPE Sports in Fort Lauderdale is a windowless warehouse-sized space in a commercial complex between a shooting range and an escape room, and immediately upon entering, you understand you're not here to film TikToks and grab ass. Kelsey has shown up in a hat with Cincinnati in minimalist block type, a logo-less black tee, black Nike shorts, and vintage LeBrons. He prefers basketball shoes for training. I don't find that much power in the shoes that are meant for more speed, he says. In the low tops, that's just what you get, the lighter fabrics. Everybody wants to feel like they're out there almost barefoot. I watch him spend an hour cycling through a series of high-tech, data-yielding drills. 15-yard flies measured by Brouwer Timing Systems lasers. Split squats calculating bar speed acceleration with the Vitruve Velocity app. Standing jumps on the Hawken force plates. Treadmill sprints. Resistance work on the Ohm Run Delta Kinetic Trainer. He's doing this in a rotation with a few other XPE clients. I like being part of the action, Kelsey says. You've got people doing it with you that motivate you. One of them is a kid who can't be more than a high school senior and who impresses me by how chill he is getting in reps with a future Hall of Famer who has more than 6 million Instagram followers. The session concludes with a half hour of legs. Dumbbell box step-ups, single leg RDLs. You don't ever get to see them, hidden by tracksuit bottoms and socks, but his legs are tremendous, real Bernini shit. And to witness him perform a Nordic hamstring curl is something I will never, ever forget. On his knees, his ankles held by his trainer, his arms at his sides, Kelsey slowly, methodically lowers his torso toward the artificial turf, the angle steadily collapsing from 90 degrees to 45 degrees to still lower, inconceivably lower, to the point where his chest is nearly parallel to the floor and seems to be levitating. Only when his nose is practically touching the turf does he extend his hands to brace himself. Then he pushes himself back up and does it a few more times. After Kelsey finishes, he lingers nearby as Tony Villani, his baseball cap curved and low like at a World Series of Poker final table, explains his approach to Kelsey's speed training. I started to realize that when you got too fast, you couldn't decelerate, Villani explains. All Travis is trying to do to the linebacker or safety is make him chase him. Once that linebacker or safety chases him and runs, he's out of control. Travis plays between 12 and 16 miles an hour. That's it. If he goes past his zone, then he turns into a track athlete and can't change direction. He caught a pass in the Super Bowl 3 years ago. He jumped it up to 19 miles an hour, the fastest speed he's hit in 3 years. Kelsey recalls and says, you know what's funny? During that run, I felt how out of control I was, and the guy had the angle on me. I just didn't even have a move. He set every tight end record known to man without ever really being above 19, Villani says with the contented look of a teacher praising their star pupil. This is what he's an artist at. This isn't just did he go from A to B as fast as possible, which he knows how to do, but he also knows how to be an artist creating illusion with agility. Vellani draws my attention to two whiteboards. Using a marker, he covers them with fractions, percentages, decimal points, arrows, triangles, triangles within triangles, and a house-shaped polygon. His arcane formula amounts to shaving a few tenths of a second off Kelsey's movements so that he can get an extra half yard of separation from a defender, so there's a higher probability of a catch than a deflection. I nod along and pretend I know what the hell he's talking about. I haven't released all this yet, but you're going to make me, Vellani says. Nothing to worry about, I think. I couldn't report on Vellani's proprietary theorem even if I wanted to. Kelsey is clearly not confused. It makes perfect sense to him. In our conversations, Kelsey is ambivalent about the meathead jock stereotype that he sometimes seems to wear, like when shortly after we speak, he goes viral for this comment about his experience guest hosting SNL. The table reading, for a guy that can't really read that well, it was kind of a fuck situation. I find it funny, he says. I joke about it. It is what it is. I'm just out here living life, he says. I don't necessarily want everyone to think I'm an idiot, but he's earnest about his belief that it's more powerful to know what you don't know. There's always something to learn. Acting like you're the smartest one in the room just isn't the way to go. Twice over dinner the night before, Kelsey told me stories that began with him missing school. The first came after his seafood restaurant Red Lobster quip. His dad was a waiter there. Ed Kelsey had a lot of jobs. His main job was sales for a company that made insulation for factory furnaces and kilns. He also picked up part-time jobs. One was at the See's Candies kiosk at Beechwood Place Mall. He never told me, Kelsey said. I found this out when I was skipping school one day and saw him there. I got right out of there. When I speak to Ed and tell him this story, he says, I've never heard this one. He must have turned and ran because he would have definitely caught hell, no question about that. The other story was about his mom's work. Donna Kelsey got her degree in communication with the aspiration to go into radio or television. It really didn't go to waste, she tells me, shortly before it's announced that she will appear in the next season of the reality competition show, The Traitors. Those industries, she said, was put up with women but didn't see us as anything serious, so she entered banking, ending up at Key Bank in Cleveland. When I would get kicked out of school for fighting, Travis said, I would sometimes have to go with my mom to work and hang out with her. Over the years, and with each successive suspension, he was able to witness his mother's ambition realized. It went from cubicles to a really nice office in the back to all of a sudden the offices are getting bigger and bigger and now she's got her name on her office. I saw my mom go through it by being a little badass kid. Donna contends her son wasn't sent home for fighting. Sometimes he went above and beyond overboard trying to make the other kids laugh. He just loved attention. She still does. God bless him. Now, Kelsey didn't tell me these stories to show how crappy he was at school. He told them to show how he gets his work ethic from his parents, how determined they were to give their two sons a chance to find and pursue their dreams, and how much he loves them for that, among so many other reasons. Still, I also knew from my research that he'd been ineligible to play football his sophomore year of high school because he failed French class and that he didn't get his college degree until 2022. So how is a guy like that, a guy during a live taping of New Heights at the University of Cincinnati, chugged a beer in a cap and gown while belatedly receiving his diploma, able to look at Tony Vellani's graffitied whiteboards and easily decipher all those complex diagrams? He's incredibly intelligent, says Jason Kelsey, but he never really cared enough about school to be in AP classes. Those are advanced placement. I was always in AP courses, and then we'd take the same proficiency test, and he'd get a higher grade. It's like, how are you getting a better math grade when you haven't even taken algebra yet? Jason then tells me a story of how one Christmas, when he was 8 and Travis was 6, they both got the same erector set. They sat at the kitchen table with their father, putting them together. Ed and Jason carefully read the instructions before beginning the assembly. When they'd read them, they looked up to find Travis had already finished. Travis has always had these moments that we refer to as Travis moments, Ed says when I ask him about the story. He will suddenly surprise you by doing something or knowing something or seeing something. Ed provides another example. When Travis was in grade school, we were called in to discuss some problems he was having, his teacher and a counselor and Donna and me. I wasn't buying that there was anything wrong with him, but I shut up, listened to them, and let them do their spiel. And the teacher said, "Travis, I want you to write your name so that I can read it." Travis was sitting across the table from her. He wrote his name upside down and backwards. Alex Smith also has had his share of Travis moments. Smith was the chief starting quarterback for Kelsey's first 5 years in the NFL before he was succeeded by Patrick Mahomes. Most people credit Mahomes with helping Kelsey achieve his full potential, including Kelsey himself. But Kelsey also acknowledges how crucial Smith was, one of my favorite teammates, favorite people in my entire career that was in his development. The Chiefs' offense favored wide receivers. As tight end, Kelsey would often be by himself on one side of the field. So he started tweaking his routes, tinkering and freestyling just to see if he could get anywhere. "I like to play to the rhythm, if you think of it as a piano player," Kelsey says. "One hand provides the structure for the song, while the other hand crafts the melody your brain can't help but follow. But I'm always on the quarterback's timing. I'm always making sure I'm not screwing up anybody else's route. But at the same time, I'm going to manipulate the defense. I'm nonstop trying to get in those guys' heads. One, keeping them in a reactionary position. But two, if I understand what this guy is being taught on this play in terms of leverage, in terms of when I threaten him, I can move him. Now I can move guys to open up windows. Now I can attract attention to open up somebody else." In Kelsey's third season, with the Chiefs offense struggling, Smith and then quarterbacks coach Matt Nagy sat down to watch a video of their most recent game. "I'll never forget," says Smith. "Every single pass play, wherever I was going, whatever the concept intended for me to throw, whatever defensive look I was getting, it didn't matter. Travis was open. He was supposed to turn out, but on this one he flipped in and he was open. He's always put a little twist on it and it worked. The number one insight for us coming out of that meeting was that we needed to get the ball to Travis more. When in doubt, get it to Travis." Soon after, they were playing the Denver Broncos. Kelsey had already caught one pass on a fake shallow cross that he turned back out. They ran it again. This time the defensive end didn't bite on the fake. "As a quarterback," says Smith, "I have to generally know where you're going to be. It's part of accountability and timing. I've got to trust that when I throw it, you're going to be there. Travis instinctively did this weird little hesitation and then just kept running this shallow cross. This is an NFL game. Never talked about this. This was not remotely a possibility for him when he installed this play. It turned into a 35-yard game. This is the brilliance of Kelsey. He did the Randy Moss. Put his hand up. There aren't many guys you can trust when they put their hand up. I trusted him and he made it right. It's pretty savant what he's been able to do." Kelsey and I are supposed to be spending an afternoon playing 9 holes of golf, but rain is forecast, so we sit in a rooftop lounge at the golf club and talk. He wears a kit for USA Basketball long sleeve shirt and sips an iced coffee. I ask him about his trademark first down gesture, one of the all-time athlete celebrations. So simple, so cocky, so devastating to opposing fans. Across from me, Kelsey chuckles, raises both hands, points his finger in the same direction, though not as emphatically as in games. It's a slight dramatic pause followed by the assertive point that makes it so savage. "When did that start?" I ask. "What was the inspiration?" "I don't know," he says. "I know Tay picked it up and she did it in New Orleans. Last October, on a Louisiana stop of her Eras tour, Swift worked the first down point into her choreography. And the internet went crazy, as it always does over anything to do with this pair. I've been looking for the right way to ask Kelsey about Swift without making him a sidekick. As it turns out, taking turns being a sidekick sits just fine with him. I get to be the plus one," he says. "I get to go and be that fan, because I am a fan. I'm a fan of music. I'm a fan of art. And it's so cool that I get to experience her being that plus one for me on the football field. I feel that same enjoyment every time she comes to my shows." A few weeks after we speak, Swift will join Kelsey in Nashville at Tight End University, a training camp and charity fundraiser Kelsey co-founded, and put on an impromptu performance. "I sort of made her a football fan," Kelsey says. "She's the most engulfed fan now. She knows what the injury reports look like. She understands what special situations are, third and short, all these things because she just naturally loves to hear about my job." Kelsey says he and Swift have a lot in common, entertaining sold-out stadiums. "I haven't experienced somebody in the same shoes as me, having a partner who understands the scrutiny, the ups and downs of being in front of millions. That was very relatable, seeing how exhausted she would get after shows. She may not think of herself as an athlete. She will never tell anyone that she's an athlete. But I've seen what she goes through. I've seen the amount of work that she puts on her body, and it's mind-blowing. Swift's training regimen of singing her entire set while running on the treadmill has been widely covered. What Kelsey emphasizes is the conditions in which she performs. To go out on stage on a computer essentially for 3 hours, the Eras Tour floor is literally, I've seen underneath that thing. It's a football field-sized computer. You take that into Singapore where it's scorching hot, and all of a sudden you're feeling the fumes from the computer and you're feeling the fumes from the sun. You're doing a show for 3 hours with a lot of energy, bringing it every single song. That is arguably more exhausting than how much I put in on a Sunday, and she's doing it 3, 4, 5 days in a row. Kelsey talks about Swift freely, with the confident admiration of a sturdy relationship, and with obvious pride, not macho pride in his having attained the seemingly unattainable or the overprotective possessiveness so often confused for chivalry. Kelsey expresses selfless pride, immaculate pride, the kind he, of traditionally Midwestern stock, has been unwilling to express about his own accomplishments when I've raised them. I think of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. How when she returned from entertaining troops in South Korea, she said, "Joe, you have never heard such cheering." And he replies, "Yes, I have." There's no such ego when Kelsey speaks of Swift praising the creative purposefulness of the Eras Tour. "Have you learned anything from her about how to hold the crowd's attention or harness its energy?" I ask. People gravitate towards how she performs and how she makes it feel like the entire stadium is in a little room with her. She's so good at mesmerizing everybody and making everybody feel like it's an intimate situation. I think that alone, there is so much calm and coolness. She's beautiful. She's up there making everyone feel at ease. When I get in front of a crowd, I feel like I've got to be like, woo, like excited, bringing the energy. Then I saw that coolness and that calmness and that relatability that she is so good at presenting. I really grabbed that. Like, man, I can use that side of entertainment as well. It's not just always being the guy that brings the energy and creates the exciting moments. I remind him of an interview in which he said his ideal partner would share some of the same qualities as his mom. Are there any similarities between the two of them, I ask? Their kindness, their genuineness, their ability to say hello to everyone in the room, he says. Their ability to show love and support no matter what. And on top of that, their work ethic. I saw my mother reach goals that she had set for herself, go from being a teller to working all the way up in the Key Bank building. Here, thinking of his mom's determination and perseverance, Kelsey gets a bit emotional and pauses briefly to collect himself. I've seen Taylor do the exact same thing of setting goals for herself and exceeding the expectations and really captivating the world in that regard. In documentaries about the Kelsey brothers, the family has been open about how Donna and Ed kept their marriage together for the sake of Travis and Jason, finally divorcing after 28 years when Travis was at college. "They were always the ultimate partners in terms of being there for us kids," Kelsey had told me. "There was no division in terms of anger at each other. I think the romance of it all might have just kind of faded, being so focused on their careers and raising a family. It's probably hard for parents to keep that romance, especially when you've got kids that are into fucking everything, you know? My brother was into so much more stuff than I was. He was a musician. He was doing all the theater stuff outside of just sport. I'm doing all these sports, 2 sports every season. So there's so much shit going on." I had asked Kelsey how visible the strain in his parents' marriage was growing up, and he recalled just one small moment. "We always had the calendar on the refrigerator of everything, and it said 25th anniversary on it. Maybe it might have been 15. I don't want to get this wrong. More so than at any other point in our conversation, Kelsey deliberated scrupulously as if he wasn't quite sure whether he should reveal this memory, and if he was going to do so, then he wanted to be certain he wasn't mischaracterizing it in any way. I don't want to get this wrong," he repeated. "It had to be around 20. Let's say 20. I remember seeing it, and I was like, oh, it's their anniversary. I wonder what they're going to do. And it was kind of just another day almost, another day of knocking out things for the kids." Kelsey was quick to explain that his parents' wedding anniversary was not overlooked out of neglect. "I'm sure my father probably did something, because he's always been very good at making sure we celebrate our mother when it's Mother's Day and all that. He still to this day will text like, hey, it's your mom's birthday coming up. Don't forget about it," Kelsey said. "At the same time, I never saw the romance of it all. A lot of friends I grew up with shared that. handful of my friends whose parents are still together and still thriving. Those situations I would love to have. Not that I think my parents dealt with it the wrong way or anything like that. It's more so, if we're going to start this, do it. Why not try and do it to last forever? Not just in a, it's just for the kids aspect. Now, sitting with him in the golf club lounge, its windows streaked with rain, I remind him of this story and ask how he and Swift, also two very career-oriented people with unrelenting schedules, managed to keep the romance from waning. Whenever I'm with her, it feels like we're just regular people, he says, not exactly answering the question. It might not need answering yet. They're only 2 years in. But he goes on, when there's not a camera on us, we're just two people that are in love. It can be perceived as something else because of how much it's talked about and how much we're tracked whenever we do go out. But I would say it's as normal of it happened very organically, even though from a media standpoint it was being tracked. It still happened very organically. Nothing I've ever done has been a controlled, organized process. When I said it was so organic, we fell in love just based off the people we were sitting in a room together with. We are two fun-loving people who have morals to appreciate everyone for who they are. We share all those values. Kind of just took the fuck off. Talking about Swift, Kelsey brings up the question of his legacy. Early in his career, he says, he was motivated by the stats and records that would be attached to his name. But nowadays, I just want to be respected and loved by the people that I'm surrounded by in my work. I want to leave it better than where it was when I started. And I see her having those same values. While Kelsey does not discuss the timing or terms of his NFL exit, he says he's been thinking about what his life looks like when he's done playing. He's now in the last year of his contract, but unlike many who've been in his position, he does not necessarily need to take a team-friendly deal or grind it out in a new city. He's built his own media enterprise, one that benefits from the fascination with his relationship with Swift, but is in no way dependent on it. Whatever he does next, he'll begin from the starting point of, roughly speaking, the largest pop cultural platform in modern American history. What will it be? Kelsey describes a process not of relentlessly upward ambition, but of a curious searching, an improvisational trial and error similar to how he mastered route running. I know to stay away from a few things that I dabbled in early, he says. There are still a couple of years on that New Heights agreement. He's got an investment in some Missouri car washes, family businesses that invest in their local communities. The whole teaming up aspect is something I've always kind of desire, he says. He's enjoyed acting and finds developing his on-camera skills satisfying. I don't necessarily know if I'll take it and run with it when I'm done playing, he says. But I know that I want to stay around the football world as a profession and then dabble in other areas as well. When he looks around at his fellow former players, he admires people like ESPN's Pat McAfee, who are making it fun. I think there is a happy medium, he says. Kelsey seems to be looking for the pieces of a life that will satisfy his abundant passion and drive, but also allow him to remain being the happiest guy in the fucking world all the time. The secret, he says, is balance. I do want to have free time. I do want to have the ability to be around my family. I don't want to get too busy when I'm traveling all over the world and I'm not present at home. A lot of players take years to figure this out after they've hung up their boots, if they ever do. Kelsey is way ahead, quietly wise. Consider it yet another Travis moment. What he's experienced of fame and influence so far, he explains, just makes him appreciate where he comes from all the more. There's an easier and a better way of life, he says. More fun way to live. That was a great, great interview and article about Travis Kelsey. I make no bones about the fact that the Kansas City Chiefs are my favorite team. They have been ever since the Rams moved to Los Angeles. Boo. And I can't get enough of Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelsey and Andy Reid and all the rest. So all the best to Travis, and I hope the Chiefs have the best season. And I hope that Travis and Taylor can stay together and make a go of it, and who knows where that leads from there. But Travis Kelsey is a unique human being, and I hope you learned a lot more about him from this article, because I sure did. Here's another interview and an article from the same issue of GQ from September of 25. This one is about the actor Ethan Hawke. How Ethan Hawke found the sweet spot. While other 90s idols raked in blockbuster paychecks, the actor took an unexpected road, writing novels, staging plays, and making low-budget indie flicks with director Richard Linklater. Now, with cinema culture firmly in its letterbox era and Hawke generating awards murmurs once again, he's showing a new generation the benefit of staying the course. Ethan Hawke strolls in for the meeting in a small, crowded cafe in Brooklyn 15 minutes early. He lives nearby with his wife of almost 20 years, Ryan, and two children, and has come straight from a parent-teacher conference. Hawke has four kids between 14 and 27, two from his marriage to Uma Thurman. When you first have kids, you don't realize how impermanent it is, he says. I'm trying not to miss anything. He's wearing a worn-in blue corduroy suit with a clashing pair of yellow striped sneakers, and if anyone in the room has recognized him, they haven't made it obvious. He slouches coolly into a packed table between diners with very little elbow room and orders an Arnold Palmer and a rocket salad, grabbing at stray bits with his hand. Hawke, now 54, has been hovering around the edges of fame since the 1980s, and he can see the passing of time in his face, the creases and lines crated across his forehead, the grays interwoven into his beard. But the eyes are still husky blue, the jaw just as chiseled as in his heartthrob days. Hawke first grabbed audiences' attention in 1989's Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams, but it was 1994's Reality Bites that turned him almost overnight into a symbol of grungy Generation X angst. That was the moment that went from me being an actor to people knowing my name, he says. Oh, he's one of those dead poet guys turned into oh, he's him. The following year, he was on the cover of Rolling Stone, cinema's answer to Pearl Jam. But while others might have leveraged that in summer blockbusters and fragrance deals, Hawke spent his 20s and 30s poking around the edges of culture, writing novels, directing plays at the theater company he co-founded, starring in Shakespeare on Broadway, and directing an independent film about the Chelsea Hotel. Some people's initial North Star is to be fucking rich and have an airplane, he says, faraway gaze snapping into focus. I was super interested in the people who made a real contribution to the arts. While not always a roadmap to box office glory, Hawke's penchant for picking offbeat parts has instead been a kind of syllabus for creative fulfillment, allowing him a discreet longevity that most actors would kill for. And it has, ironically, now made him the perfect star for the letterboxed era, when teenagers excitedly lauded their favorite Luca Guadagnino movie and the $6 million Nora wins Best Picture over Dune Part 2 and Wicked. I'm a believer, says Hawke. That can come off pretentious, but it's so much better than being cynical. Cynicism kind of breaks your kneecaps. This autumn, Hawke is starring in three projects that show his range, showing his spooky side as the villain in horror sequel Black Phone 2, dipping into prestige TV with berserk drama Lowdown, and starring as a 5-foot Broadway legend in The Sweet, Sad Blue Moon, directed by his longtime collaborator, Richard Linklater. Linklater has now directed Hawke in 9 feature films. They met one night in 1993 through a mutual friend and ended up staying up chatting until 4:30 a.m. Afterwards, the director sent Hawke a script that would become 1995's Before Sunrise, an eccentric little idea about a guy and a girl meeting on a train and spending an unplanned evening strolling through Vienna, talking about love and the meaning of life. He was the hot commodity. He was the guy, Linklater recalls. But you would never know it. He was living in his little West Village apartment. He had none of the trappings of a Hollywood star. He was a beatnik. The entirety of the Before Sunrise script is basically just two actors talking. No major plot devices, no wild action, no real side characters to pick up any slack. A careerist, someone who was worried about being the next whatever, would be going, this seems risky. This could set my career back. I'm not going to do this. Ethan was kind of like, huh, how the fuck did we pull this off, says Linklater. That's the difference between a full-on movie star and an artist. Their latest, Blue Moon, is a biopic about Lorenz Hart, the ill-fated 20th century lyricist who, alongside songwriting partner Richard Rodgers, gave the world melancholy standards like My Funny Valentine. It seems in character for Hawke that while some of his fellow 90s leading men cohort are working as glorified stuntmen in $300 million blockbusters, he's starring in a strange and small paean to the poetic temperament, a shy portrait of what it actually feels like and cosmically costs to be a creative master. It's a film about art as much as it is art itself. People like Lorenz, they're like an antenna, absorbing all the confusing, beautiful, wonderful, sad, tragic, heroic elements mixed into each other, and it kind of breaks their brain. They feel things, Hawk says, and we need those things to be felt. Hawk had close encounters with genius early in his career. He worked with the late River Phoenix for both their film debuts in 1985's Explorers and Robin Williams, of course, in Dead Poets Society. He learned from both of them what brilliance looks like, but also saw what show business can do to vulnerable and eager talents pushed over the edge. Hawk said it's partly luck that he doesn't have inclinations towards self-destructive behavior, but it's also fortunate that he was never that famous. He auditioned for Leonardo DiCaprio's role in Titanic, but in retrospect feels relieved he didn't land it. I don't think I would have handled that success as well as Leo, he says. He was a fucking beetle. Instead, he gravitated towards filmmakers who could stoke his creativity. Part of the appeal of Before Sunrise was that Linklater invited Hawk and his co-star Julie Delpy to contribute dialogue informed by their own life experience, giving the actors a poetic outlook in addition to a paycheck. When he showed up in Vienna, it was just us sitting down to make this movie work, Linklater says. We're not half-assing it. We're reaching for something. It's the all-in-ness that Ethan brings to what he does, which is exciting. Before Sunrise is now considered one of the great love stories in movie history, and Linklater and Hawk have since worked together on two equally beloved sequels, 2004's Before Sunset, 2013's Before Midnight, as well as the achingly beautiful Boyhood, which filmed in real time across 12 years, tracks the saga of one family as they literally grow up. It's these films that have been the best windows into what Hawk can do. There's an authenticity, a grizzled charm, and a combination of intellectualism and sincerity in every facial flicker. He's the person at the party talking about art almost too earnestly. The intensity, the life lived. You feel the inner workings, Linklater says of watching Hawk on screen. He's the guy who has a mind on fire. Hawk's closest call with being a paparazzi mainstay came in the late 1990s and early 2000, when he was married to Uma Thurman. But the headiness of that brief period, at the height of Y2K tabloid culture, only served to show him what he didn't want. It's humiliating. It's almost humiliating even when they're saying positive things, he says. Their relationship, which ended in 2003, was itself really a result of him chasing cinematic enchantment. They fell in love while making 1997's Gattaca. Have you ever played Spin the Bottle, he says, when I ask why actors often fall in love on set? There's a certain intimacy to the work that we do. Imaginative intimacy. It's such a high. It feels dangerous and thrilling. It turns the temperature up in your life. It can be like falling in love at summer camp. It doesn't have any connection to the dailiness of real life. That's the danger of it. Notably, Hawks never led a big-budget franchise like Mission Impossible or launched a tequila brand. I never self-identified as a movie star. I was allergic to that, he says. Having a trademark by my name and making $1 million, that wasn't part of my dream. Even in Training Day, arguably his most mainstream blockbuster, he was content to play second fiddle to Denzel Washington. Hawk scored an Oscar nomination for the film in 2002, but Washington took home the gold statue. Still, to Hawk, the nod felt like genuine encouragement from his peers. Proof that if you just show up and do the best work you can, somebody's going to notice. I didn't campaign at all. Nobody took out an ad for me, he says. Now it's political in a way. We can thank Harvey Weinstein for turning it into a junket. The industry learned that you can make money off those awards, so they start investing. With Blue Moon, the awards chatter will likely start again for the first time in a while. But Hawk is unfazed about the prospect of hitting the promo circuit. It's work I'm proud of, he says. He has, it seems, settled into what might be the perfect level of fame. Enough to warrant a red carpet fit every now and then, but not so much that TMZ is tracking him down. It gives him the luxury to futz around and find audiences in unlikely places. Over the years, he's played Nikola Tesla, a mythological Norse king, Chet Baker, and Hamlet. There were whole periods of my life that I felt really uncomfortable with, he says, but now I just see them with a smile. He's also had some surprise successes in horror movies, including 2012's Sinister, 2013's The Purge, and 2021's The Black Phone. He's directed his daughter, Maya, in a film based on the life of writer Flannery O'Connor, and the time of writing is working on a documentary about Merle Haggard, for which he's over the moon to say he has interviewed Willie Nelson. He written 6 books, including 2 graphic novels. He has a cameo in a 2024 Taylor Swift and Post Malone video. There are people who think I'm only in horror movies. There are people who think, what have you done since Training Day? There are people who think all I should ever do is work with Richard Linklater, he says. My career has kind of been a little spiderwebby. Even with his artistic aspirations, Hawke has proven unafraid to meet the industry where it is at any given moment. He'll play a despondent reverend in Paul Schrader's 2017 critically adored but little seen First Reformed, then work beside Julia Roberts in something like the 2023 thriller Leave the World Behind, which had tens of millions of views in its first week on Netflix. When he made a foray into the MCU in the miniseries Moon Knight, he let slip in an interview that he turned down similar roles in the past for fear of getting stuck. Money is as money does. You can use it for freedom. A lot of the best movies I've done don't pay you very well. You've got to do something that's relevant to contemporary audiences. The idea of artistic integrity is a real balancing act, he says now. Paul Schrader can want you, but if he can't raise the money with you attached, you're going to lose that role. It's real. If you pay attention to it too much, you lose the plot. This autumn sees Hawke's first major leading role in a streaming series in The Lowdown, an FX show from Reservation Dogs co-creator Sterling Harjo. Streaming is often a tricky space for actors steeped in the traditions of indie cinema, but this in no way feels like a capitulation. It's a gonzo drama about a conspiracy theorist slash citizen journalist on the trail of a local mystery in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I can sit here and piss and moan about how independent cinema is dying, Hawke says, or I can realize that the independent spirit can exist anywhere. I felt Sterling doing that. Hawke is a maniac in the role, barreling through much of the first episode with a blood-covered face, beaten up and bruised from some violent early encounters. He wanders in and out of scenes like he just woke up in a daze, imbuing the screen with a dreamy naturalism. This character represents the thing that Ethan and I are attracted to, people who walk on the edge of magic and beauty and insanity and darkness. He's navigating this razor blade of life, says Harjo. The way he performs is intoxicating. If The Lowdown showcases Hawke at his wildest, Blue Moon is a quieter part, a portrait of heartbreak and isolation set over a single evening in 1943. Lorenz Hart, played by Hawke, is at real-life Broadway watering hole Sardis to attend a party for the opening of Oklahoma, the musical smash composed by his old creative partner, Richard Rodgers. The two had written a string of musicals through the 1920s and 30s, but by the early 1940s, Rodgers had turned his attention away from Hart and towards the more practical and easier to work with lyricist and librettist Oscar Hammerstein II. Oklahoma would become the first of many Rodgers and Hammerstein productions. Blue Moon, named from one of the enduring songs Hart and Rodgers wrote together, follows Hart's descent into despair and abject drunkenness as a reaction to the new play's success. Characters played by Margaret Qualley, Andrew Scott, and Bobby Cannavale saunter in and out of the action, but the script, written brilliantly by Robert Paplow, is mostly a series of poetic monologues spoken by Hart about love, music, and life, essentially a one-man show. It's undeniably in the moment, says Qualley. I think it's a pretty astonishing performance. During filming in Ireland, Hawke maintained a monk-like existence, which allowed him to show up at set each and every day with as full a battery as possible. To physically transform into Hart, Hawke had to appear balding, he shaved his head, and 5 feet tall, which the film achieved through a series of stagecraft tricks. A closeted and unfulfilled genius with a drink problem, Hart vacillates wildly, sometimes within the space of one sentence, between charming and crass, endearing and embarrassing, funny and nasty, hopeless, hopeful and hopeless. Hawke is delightfully bitchy one moment and painfully pitiful the next. I had to come in on all cylinders. That movie took everything. I didn't go out in the world for a couple months, he says. I just disappeared. In some ways, it's Linklater's love letter as much to Hawke as it is to Hart, the best possible showcase of what his close friend is capable of after so many years working together. The film seems minimal at one level, but man, it's maximalist work from Ethan's perspective, Linklater says. You have to remove a big part of yourself and fill it up with this life you imagine. That's what artists do. Kind of magical transference. The lunch rush is over. A sprinkling of rain has passed. Hawke orders an espresso and we're practically alone in the cafe apart from some patrons lingering at the bar. No one has asked him for a selfie or interrupted to tell him how much they love his work. Hawk admits there are times that fame, however relative, can warp things, and he's needed reality checks to help him recalibrate. My wife is really funny. We'll go out to dinner, and I'll say, God, the waiter was rude. And she'll say, they weren't rude. They just didn't recognize you. They were normal. You're just used to seeing everybody smiling when they see you or offering you an extra thing or moving you up in line, he says. The problem with that kind of attention is that a normal temperature feels cold. When you get tickets to the game and you're sitting 10 rows back and not in the front, you feel like someone fucked you over. That's funny. Maybe then the biggest gift Hawk has been granted is that his success is just enough. It's insulated him from the daily grind that most of us face, but never so much that it severed him from everyday human experience. Best of all, he's managed to hang on to something rare, that sense of idealism and unspoiled curiosity. It's who he is, says Harjo. There's a lot of people who get jaded, get burned out. It's nice to know that it's possible to navigate a career where you also still hold on to the joy of why you started it in the first place. It seems blissful, a golden in-between, never too comfortable, never too stressed, always just present. When you're a young, good-looking guy, everyone assumes you're getting laid every time you turn around, and no one is pulling for you. They love you to self-destruct, in fact, Linkletter says. You just got to settle in. Run the whole race. He did. Now, as he edges into his mid-50s, Hawk says he's gratified that his choices could be a blueprint for younger actors, including for his daughter Maya, an actor best known for her role in Stranger Things. It doesn't matter if you say, don't smoke, if you're smoking. It doesn't matter if you say, don't do it for the money, when all you do is do things for money, he says. The one thing I do say to her is, it's a long life. There's plenty of time to make mistakes. That's great. That's a great advice. When he looks at Hollywood's burgeoning heartthrobs, the Paul Mescals and the Jacob Elordis of the world, he sees, in their embrace of interesting parts and serious acting, a sign of brightness for the movie business at a pivotal moment. I like seeing young people who care. I like seeing people who aren't interested in the algorithm, he says. If you spend your life dedicated to the arts, that's about maintaining a connection to yourself and not trying to think about what other people might want to receive. Finding his own continued sense of purpose in projects like Blue Moon, Hawk has been freed from the pressure to treat every single film like a grand statement to live or die by. Make a movie, release it, move on. Camp it up in a scary thriller, go nuts in a Gonzo TV show, then try something else. After our meeting, he tells me he'll walk straight from the cafe to an editing room, antsy as ever, to get back to his Merle Haggard documentary. I don't know how to operate if I don't feel like the best is yet to come. You see interviews with musicians. They always think their new album is their best album. It doesn't matter. It just ends the new thing, he says, getting up to amble with me out into the gray New York day. That's how I feel all the time. And that was a really good insight into who Ethan Hawke is and what he is all about. And he has made some excellent movies over the years, and if you haven't seen a lot of them, maybe go back and go to IMDb and Google Ethan Hawke and find some of his great movies. I never watched the Before Sunset movies, and I think I'm going to have to go back with my wife and watch those because they sound like something right up our alley. My wife and I are big. We really like, I don't know, different kinds of movies. We like independent films. We like big movies too, but we're just not big fans. Like Ethan says, we're not big fans of, you know, superhero movies or fantasy movies. You know, these big movies with lots of CGI and stuff. I just have never been a fan of. But so Ethan Hawke is somebody who's right up my alley. I've liked a lot of his movies, and if you've never seen Good Will Hunting or some of the other ones I talked about, go back and watch some of them because he is an artist. Well, that's about all the time we have, folks, for this week's Men's Hour show. Please tune in again next week, and I hope that you enjoy all the great programming that's available to you right here on Mind's Eye 24/7. There's some great stuff out here, magazines, news articles, books, all kinds of great shows. So if you haven't had a chance to browse around and see what's out on the website, please do that. There's a lot of people here who go out of their way to record shows, and the folks who work in the office. There's just a lot of people who are behind the scenes here who make this happen. I'm just the guy who reads some of the news. So if you get a chance, take a look at the website, and please consider donating to Mind's Eye if you are able to do that. There's a way to do that right on the website. And by the way, in relation to this particular show, you know, I'm just guessing at what you guys like to hear, and I'm maybe I'm hitting, maybe I'm missing. But if there's anything you want to hear that you're not hearing, certain magazines, certain types of articles, anything, I'm open. So I'm going to just go on a limb here and say my name is Steve Walden, and if you want to hear something on this show that you're not hearing, or you have any suggestions or comments, or you just want to bitch at me about something, just text me. I'm going to give you my phone number, and you can text me anything you want about this particular show. I'll be happy to make some changes if that's possible. So you can text me, Steve Walden, at 314-606-9878. And again, if you want to see what all the programs are that you can listen to, you can listen live, whatever's going out there right now, or you can pull up different shows that have been recorded previously. But go to mindseyeradio.org to find the shows, find a way to donate if you're able to do that. There's an ultimate beepball tournament that happens every year, which is kind of fun. You play baseball, basically, with blinders on, with a mask on, just like folks would if they were blind. It's a lot of fun. It's very humbling, to be honest with you. I played it once, and it was difficult for me, but you do get a peek, so to speak, into what it's like to be blind, which is a pretty cool thing to see. So anyway, please support Mind's Eye, and I hope you enjoy all the programming right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care, everybody. Have a great week, and enjoy this fabulous weather.